The Hebrew Order of David is one of our community's oldest and most established global outreach organizations. Join Stan Clare for the next hour as he explores the issues facing the men in the community. The HOD Hour is a fundraising initiative for the HOD. Welcome to the HOD Hour with Stan Clare. This is the HOD Hour with Stan Clare.
And I'm Stan Clare, and good evening, and I'm privileged to have as my guest Professor Randall Schnurr, a sociologist from the prestigious York University in Toronto. He's a research consultant and a sociologist specializing in the qualitative study of contemporary Canadian Jewish life. Good evening, Professor.
Good evening. How are you, Stan?
Wonderful, and it's great to have you on the show. Before we start, I just want to give you a bit of background. It's a bit of background, a sort of general background. So a few months ago, I came across an article, and I was doing some research, and I found an article about a young man by the name of Shir Schnurr, who decided to forego his bar mitzvah, the traditional bar mitzvah, and head off to Colombia with his family and their baseball gear to teach and to coach kids in the impoverished rural community in the province of Choco, one of the poorest areas in Colombia. So, of course, I had to delve further in for two reasons. Number one, my grandfather's name was Shia. And number two, I was fascinated by the story. And having dug a little deeper, I came across Professor Schnurr and found him to be a prolific writer and an intriguing range of subjects. And that's why we're talking to him tonight. Can you give us a bit more of what happened with the baseball, and then we'll launch into the rest of the show?
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's wonderful. I was not aware that you had read the article about my son. He just had his bar mitzvah here in Toronto. And as you said, as part of his bar mitzvah project, his Tikkun Olam project, he loves baseball, he loves to travel, and he loves to help others. So we put together a very meaningful and memorable experience in Colombia, where we worked with an organization called Project Baseball, and we spent a week there this past April, and we had collected several boxes of baseball equipment, which we had sent down, and then we spent time in, as you say, the more impoverished areas of Colombia and in a state called Choco, and we were in several communities and we met the kids and we played a lot of baseball with them, and it was a wonderful cultural exchange for my son and for my family.
Well, that really is an indication of good parenting, bringing up your child to understand the ways of the world and needs of the communities. It slots completely into the background and the actual direction of the Hebrew Order of David International. And going further with that, we have had a lot of immigration from South Africa, as people do know, and a lot of that, of those immigrants ended up in Canada. And Professor Schnurr has done research, it's called the Southern Africa Legacy Project, and it involves Jews from South Africa and how are they happy, are they successful, are they integrated, are they involved, are they influential, and I'm sure the answer to most of that is yes, but can you elucidate?
Why don't we start at the beginning? As you say, I was commissioned to conduct this demographic study of the many South Africans that were in Toronto. This was done through the Ontario Jewish Archives. Ontario, of course, is the province where Toronto is located, here in Toronto.
Right.
And these archives have been involved in a project, as you said, the South African Legacy Project, which is quite an amazing project to collect photographs, oral testimonies, which are available online, and other personal artifacts of the South African immigrants here to Canada. So part of this project was to conduct this large study, which I was involved in with a colleague. by the name of Charles Chacar from Montreal. And it was a pleasure to undertake this study. This is a very enthusiastic community here of South Africans who were eager to participate in the study. And we had a nice large sample size. And where shall we begin? Should we talk about the immigration patterns, or where would you like to begin?
Yes, so from a South Africa point of view, in the 80s, 90s, we experienced, and I mean it continues today, a lot of immigration from South Africa. And of course, their destinations of choice were English-speaking countries, Australia, United Kingdom, and of course Canada. A lot went to Israel. And we, in fact, the Hebrew Order of David has a lodge based in Toronto, in Thornhill, where we have a number of our ex-South Africans there mixed with a number of Canadians, and I'm familiar with a lot, you know, with a lot of them and know their background. But it's interesting that you would have chosen the South Africans. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of other nationalities, Jewish from different countries that came to Canada. And why South Africans?
Yes, in Toronto we have a number of interesting Jewish communities. We have a lot of Israelis, of course, a lot of Russian Jews, Latin American Jews, Persian Jews, and others. But I would say the South African community is one of the well-known ones, one of the more prominent ones. And people within the community here took an interest to put together this project out of, you know, pride in their community and the desire to share with others the accomplishments of the community, and they approached the Ontario Jewish Archives, and this project was put together. So, you know, as you say, Jews from South Africa have emigrated to several places, Israel, United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, the USA, and Canada is really the fifth area of settlement. It's one of the smaller ones, but there are perhaps 7,000 or 8,000 South African Jews, depending on how you define who is a South African Jew. And most of them came here to Canada. About 2/3 of them came actually in the 1970s and 80s, right. Mostly young adults and highly educated people. Most of them from Johannesburg, about 70% from Johannesburg, about 18% from Cape Town, and a few from other places.
Yes, so at that time already they had migrated from the country towns in South Africa and had settled in Cape Town, Johannesburg mainly, and of course Durban, some in the Eastern Cape. But and of course the South African Jewish population is largely emanating from Lithuania, the majority of South African Jews were from Lithuania, and that's the genealogy of the community. And so you've got you've taken, dare I say it, the cream of the crop have emigrated and settled in different parts of the world. And tell us a little bit about how they've settled in. I mean, clearly they have.
Yes, they have. It's interesting you say the cream of the crop are the ones that left. Some of our respondents did say that, but I'm sure there's a lot of cream of the crop still there in South Africa as well. But, you know, why Canada? Of course, it's an English-speaking country, a large established Jewish community here. Perhaps people have family here. And it's a peaceful country, of course. It has the political stability that people were trying to find, where you had a lot of instability, of course, in the 70s and civil unrest, etc. So there was a lot of reasons to come to Canada, but I would like to outline some of the challenges or adjustments that are interesting to think about.
The weather mainly.
Weather is definitely one of them, Stan. That's right. It's not only the cold weather we have here. You know, from about November till March, it's fairly cold and some might say miserable here in Toronto. And so not only is it an adjustment to the cold weather, But it's also, it's a way of life. From what I understand, life in South Africa is to a large extent, you know, spent outdoors in people's gardens, or as we call them, backyards here, and having get-togethers and stopping in spontaneously and socializing. Whereas when you have a climate for several months a year where nobody wants to be outside, it changes also the social dynamic, and people are shut into their homes more. And that is in itself is an adjustment. Do you know what I mean, Stan?
No, that absolutely describes it as it is, because in South Africa we do try to spend our time outside. We're a good sporting nation, and you know the sporting teams of the country are well supported. But I think that crime here, unfortunately, has meant that they're high walls, and because of that, you tend to have less of the dropping in and more of, you know, dropping in by appointment type of thing or by invitation. And yes, I would imagine that South Africans are pretty friendly people. I'm sure that they must have taken advantage of eating together, and I think integrating into Canadian society. Although when I was there, the few times that I've been there, it seems to me as if the South Africans tend to stick together, or are they integrating generally into society?
Yes, well, I'll get to that in a moment. I'd say a little bit of both. I think they are quite close-knit, and the friendship networks among South Africans are quite high. Although the longer one is here in Canada, the less that one's majority of friends are South Africans. That's a natural process of integration, I think. And you start to make more friends within the larger Jewish community and larger society. But I would say South Africans in general, as Jews are in general, are a tight-knit group with high friendship networks, with what we call high residential concentration, which simply means they like to live together in the same neighborhoods, Thornhill here in Toronto being one of them, yeah, as you mentioned. Just getting back for a moment to the immigration, it's an interesting case, because when we think of Jews who are emigrating, we often think of the narrative of, you know, leaving with just the clothes on your back and no money in your pocket and being forced to flee immediately. And as we know, this is not the case with most South Africans who, although we're facing difficult political situation and violence for sure, I don't think it was directly an anti-Semitic situation. And you have people, I mean, you can comment if you think I need to be corrected, but you have people who are generally financially well off and well educated and are actually set back somewhat financially to come. So in some ways we call this a reverse immigration, where people are coming with fairly well off and are set back and are having challenges with their credentials being accepted in a new country. But as we'll go on to see, the South Africans have generally done very well and have adjusted economically. And we can talk more about that as we go along.
Yes, I think what's happened lately, which I think in the 70s and 80s perhaps, there was a better exchange rate. So, you know, the rand bought more dollars than it does today. And so that might have been somewhat of an advantage, but it certainly was a disadvantage, as you say, when they left here with rands and had to convert it into dollars when they got to Canada or wherever they were going for that matter. But as you said at the beginning, a lot of them were educated, so which meant that they could go and they could find work and they could be employed, which wasn't so much the case when immigration to South Africa started in the way back in the early 1900s and so on, where, you know, they were facing much more difficult times.
Mm. Another interesting adjustment that I want to mention, which is sometimes neglected in these studies, is the issue of gender. And in this case, the adjustments that women needed to make, and especially in the 70s and 80s, where, as I understand, women were more likely to be at home, taking care of the home, and the man was the main breadwinner. Upon arrival to Canada at that time, this often involved really a transformation of the family structure, where first of all, you no longer have a maid to cook the meals and take care of the house and perhaps take care of the children. And the woman often takes on the role, more of the role of taking care of the house, but also to go out into the workforce, whether full-time or part-time. And then women are taking on a double responsibility. And for women, this was quite a change in their lifestyle.
That resonates, because what happens, I think, also, which they didn't have the advantage of having grandparents in the equation. And so, like in South Africa today, you know, there's families, the grandparents can assist with when the families, I mean, wives today are working more and more. There's definitely the need for two incomes in South Africa. It's not as economically strong as it used to be. And I think that, you know, costs are high, schooling is high, et cetera. So I think, yes, but I think one of the losses and that's what people have told me when they went, they missed the structure of the nuclear family where, you know, there were grandparents and, you know, ready-made babysitters and schleppers and so on, which you know, they had to fend for themselves when they got to another country, plus go to work, plus, you know, school the children. And so I'm sure that must have been quite daunting.
Yes, it's interesting. I married a Mexican Jewish woman who came to Canada as a teenager, and that's as part of our Colombia trip. We also went to Mexico City to visit her family, and of course she knows Spanish. But the reason I bring this up is when my in-laws arrived to Canada from Mexico City in the 1980s, one of the adjustments, which is similar, I think, is that they were able to have a maid in Mexico City making all their meals, cleaning the house. And from what I understand, it's an adjustment when all those responsibilities are no longer taken care of.
Yes, so. That is definitely, I mean, that's the pattern here for very many reasons. But, domestic help in most homes, is part of a way of life here. And it's certainly what I've seen overseas, it certainly isn't. But having said that, I see that a lot of homes bring in assistance, they bring in help, they have au pairs to look after the children. So it's not as if they have completely no support.
Here in Canada, you mean?
Yes.
Yes, but not to the same extent. For a middle class family to have someone there full time wouldn't be as common. But yes, you do see various levels of that. I wanted to bring up another point and see what you thought. Some of the immigrants who came in around the mid 90s spoke about something called post-apartheid guilt, where they felt that apartheid had finally ended, and here they've left the country and in a sense abandoned it and weren't there to help contribute to building a new South African society. And I wouldn't say many people said that, but a few. Have you ever heard of this idea?
So definitely there has been talk around that, but I think there's with good reason, because a lot of people who left the country had good education here. You know, they took advantage of what was going on in South Africa. It was to their advantage. And so, yes, they took away what they'd been given and went to another country. And I guess that might have produced a little bit of guilt. But I don't think that's really the mainstream of thought of people who left here. I think they left because, despite the fact that apartheid had ended, they didn't see futures for their children, and so they took what they had, and they and they went to look for a better life. And, you know, I can understand that fully. I'm fortunate in one way that my children still live here, but I mean, the reverse could be true when, you know, children want to leave and they have to go to another country. But you know, one does what one has to do within where you live. And then when, if they move, take it. I don't think that guilt is that prominent in the thoughts of people leaving the country. I would doubt that. They might not, they might have had a nice life here and they might be sorry to leave it, but I'm not sure that, you know, having lived through apartheid and having benefited from it, that they had guilt in leaving. I haven't come across that in the, mm-hmm. I've had that discussion, but I haven't had a lot of it. It's not prominent in the discussion yet.
That confirms really what I found is that it was mentioned once or twice among, you know, a large, large sample. It was something that I hadn't thought about, and I found it quite, quite interesting. So I wanted to mention that.
I think there's another side to that, actually. There's the, quite the opposite. I think that in many cases, there might have been a resentment of people remaining here that others had left the country having had the benefit of what took place in South Africa and having had the benefit of that and now used that and left the country and, you know, to do it. But I think that's also gone by the way. People are looking at the world completely differently, certainly from a South African point of view. I mean, there's still a steady stream of people leaving. There's a lot of those that are here who, you know, are bound by what they have. Financially, families and so on that don't want to leave, but, you know, one has to do what one feels is best. And I suppose if you're young, you go, you don't think about all the other things that are going on. You just got one thing in mind. Can I make a living? Can my kids be educated and so on?
Yes. I can imagine it's a difficult situation or a question which is always in the air for young couples. And I understand people are still leaving, and from the numbers I've seen, Australia seems to be a popular location in the last decade or so. Is that what you're seeing?
I think that people would like to go there. I'm not sure that it's as easy as it was. I think there are barriers to entry, but yes. We're going to take a short break, Professor, just if you don't mind holding on. We're just going to pay the rent, and then we'll be back.
Branding is what people say about you when you aren't in the room. To find out how High FM can work for your brand, call us on 010-140-4090.
Hey agent, listen up. I went with my mom to the Sound Single gift shop, and I have this amazing toy shop. It's the best kept secret. They have the biggest range of our generation dolls and accessories. The whole range of Melissa and Doug. The play food and kitchen stuff is awesome. They've got Lego, the top model range of books and stickers, props, puzzles, games. And for your baby brothers and sisters, there's the gigantic brass stars range. The Sowen Siegel Toy Shop, it'll be our secret. Ask for secret agent Auntie Andy. The Sowen Siegel Toy Shop is located inside the Sowen Siegel Gift Shop, George Avenue, Sandringham. Shh, it's our secret.
This is the HOD Hour with Stan Claff.
And we're back. We're talking to Professor Randall Schnur, who's a sociologist teaching at York University in Toronto. And we're discussing the migration of South African Jews and their destination being, one of the destinations being Canada. And this is part of the subject of research that's been done by Professor Schnur. And we want to continue where we left off. Those that have gone, I would feel were flexible enough to settle in. Well, I think South Africans generally, we have an expression in South Africa called boer maak 'n plan, which means a farmer makes a plan. And I'm sure they say, maar 'n Jood maak 'n beter plan, which they say is, a Jew makes a better plan. So, so having left the country, I'm sure when they went to, Canada or wherever they ended up, I'm sure they, fitted into society and made a success of their lives in the, to a large extent. I'm sure that's some battle, but at the end of the day, I have faith in the community that they can adapt and make a success. How have you found that?
Yes, the community has adapted very well, I would say, socially. Maybe we could talk a little bit about economically now.
Yes, I think that's important.
An economic comfort level really, you know, goes a long way to feeling comfortable in a country. And the satisfaction levels of the South Africans that we spoke to was quite high. 79% felt very much at home in Canada. And that this increases the longer you're here, the more that is. I'll just mention as an aside, as part of this study, we compared a lot of findings to a very similar study done on South Africans who had migrated to the United Kingdom. I don't know if you're aware of that, that we had that as part of our study. And it was interesting to see that the South Africans who migrated to Canada seemed to show a more of a comfort level with their new country than the ones who went to the UK on a few variables. I'll just throw that out there for a moment. But in terms of economic adaptation, we see here very high socioeconomic achievement with this community, despite the adjustments that needed to be made. You know, how did they do so well? Again, a well-educated community, highly skilled, hardworking. You know, emigration is very difficult, and you need a lot of determination to pull it off, as we were alluding to earlier. These are people who are willing to take some risks. I interviewed a non-Jewish accountant here in Toronto who married a South African Jewish woman and was very familiar with the South African Jewish community in Toronto, and he described it as a certain entrepreneurial spirit and a risk taker willing to venture out and start your own business or start your own venture. So a common profession here, as you may not be surprised, is in the field of finance and accounting.
Yes.
We have many South African Jewish accountants here in Toronto. And I think that this is because it's an easily transferable skill where the credentials were accepted fairly easily as opposed to some other professions. And I was told that in the 1970s, Canadian banks and accounting firms were actually actively recruiting in South Africa looking for accountants. And perhaps South Africans were looking for opportunities abroad, and a match was made. And there are even Jewish accounting firms here in Toronto who had affiliate offices in Johannesburg who would, through their social and professional networks, recruit Jewish South African accountants to Toronto. So that was an interesting development within the world of occupational integration. Does that...
That absolutely is, that's spot on. I mean, as far as South African, first of all, accounting at one stage was, you know, you couldn't get into medicine, so you took up accounting, and accountants are really, you know, at some point in South Africa, we're riding the crest of the wave. It's become quite difficult being an accountant in South Africa because the regulations have become more and more stringent, but at that time, I mean, a lot of these people went to universities where the degrees were accepted around the world. I think that was essentially how they got there in the first place and why they took that decision. And yes, I know a lot of South African accountants who went, over. When you compared it to England, I think the UK was a lot tougher. I don't think that, I think that was reasonably easy in the accounting and finance professions to get work. But I think that a lot of them, I know a number of people who actually came back because the work ran out. The UK was going through a bit of a slump. It seems to me that those went to Canada. I do know a few who did return or went elsewhere, but most of them that I'm aware of went exactly as you said and found work. Some were enticed by companies. I know a few accountants who worked for firms which, you know, had international branches, and certainly they were recruited to be taken over. And there were some pretty good accountants who left here.
I'm sure. It appears that one's choice of destination can depend on one's profession and where the work would be more easily found and the credentials accepted, and whether it be Australia or the UK or elsewhere. In terms of medicine and doctors, I think, from what I understand, in the earlier decades of the 70s or 80s, it wasn't terribly difficult to come to Canada and work in the field of medicine, but I've been told more recently it's not as easy, and we don't see as many doctors coming over in the more recent times.
So there was a lot of recruitment of doctors from South Africa to the United States, particularly in Texas, other areas where they were assisted to come over and work there. And I mean, South African doctors had a brilliant education. South African medical degrees were highly sought after. And, you know, today it's completely different because of the racial dynamic here. So at that time it was much easier for them to get into the medical schools and so on. So they took advantage of it, and certainly they left. It was a lot easier at that stage to do accountancy and other to get in because there were limited spaces in the medical faculties. But nevertheless, there was a large number of South African doctors who qualified here and left almost immediately after qualifying in the 70s and 80s.
Mm. But yes, that's exactly what I heard about more going to the United States in the last 10 or 20 years, and Houston and other places in Texas were mentioned. So it's a matter of some of the bureaucracy of how your credentials are going to be accepted or not accepted. Interestingly, in the field of law, we're used to seeing, of course, a high proportion of Jews in the law profession, but in this case, this was a field where it was not easy, as you may know, to transfer over to Canada.
Right. I think there's a very different way of doing law in other countries as opposed to South Africa, which is based on Roman, Dutch, and English law, whereas which surprises me actually that Canada would be difficult, because I would imagine it's based on English law as well.
I believe it's a different form of law here. And it was actually a lawyer who was involved in the committee to put this project together. And he explained to me that it has been difficult to have your credentials accepted at par here in Canada. And as a result, there are not a high proportion of lawyers. So that was an interesting finding.
So there is a prevalence of South African Jews there, because we have the Hebrew Order of David has a lodge there. Because of the immigration, mm-hmm. we managed to open up in right throughout America. So we have in Atlanta, we have in right through Texas, that's Dallas and Houston, and we have in Boca Raton, we have in San Diego, and then of course we have in Canada. And been there, the times that I've been there, if you go to shul, you know, I see a lot of South African faces and familiar, you know, friends who've left here and went to live in Canada. And of course they joined the Hebrew of David, so we have quite a strong branch in Thornhill. And you know, so I am familiar with the community, not all of them, but I do know that South Africans have become part of society. But I wanted to know, you mentioned in the study influence. So are any of these ex-South Africans entering politics, or are they more just on commercial and making a living and carrying on like that?
Yeah, very little in in politics, in our sample at least, a lot in finance, opening their own business, accounting or education, a little bit in health and medicine. Why do you ask about going into politics?
Well, I'm interested to know whether South Africans go beyond the commercial side of things, whether they do get involved in other countries. In it's not my experience. I find that very few of them, you don't hear of them coming up in the world of politics at all. I mean, you do hear from time to time, but it doesn't seem to be something which they strive for. Maybe it's maybe they're wise and they don't want to get involved.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. That didn't come up in our study. I would think South Africans could do very well in politics, but as you say, it's not something that they've chosen to a large extent.
The truth is that in South Africa, Jews didn't really get involved. They did to an extent, but a very small extent in the high levels of politics here. It's as they've become a little bit more involved now that apartheid is over. But during the apartheid years, it was, you mean, there were a number, of course, they are very prominent. They, a lot of them working behind the scenes, but a lot of them, the public face of Jews here, were involved in politics and very successfully. In one way, I mean, it depends what you, how you define success, but, going overseas, you don't hear the names linked to politics in very many ways. And I'm talking about also right throughout the world. I mean, England, United Kingdom, Canada, United States and so on. They seem to get involved in the communities and in the shuls and so on, and probably that's where their sphere of influence is, but doesn't seem that they're into the mainstream.
Interesting. Perhaps we can talk a little bit about the Jewish identities and behaviors of South African Jews.
Yes, that's important.
Because this is an area that I specialize in terms of Jewish identity, and it was fascinating to see how South African Jews may compare to Canadian Jews in terms of sort of their Jewish observance, their Jewish identities, and Jewish behaviors. And one of the striking findings is that when you start to look at South Africans coming to Canada is that many of them identify as Orthodox, or at least traditional. And what's happening in the early decades is that a Canadian Jew would say, oh, you're Orthodox? Oh, you're completely Shomer Shabbat? You're keeping the Sabbath? You're strictly kosher? And the South African would say, well, no, I'm not strictly kosher. I'm not completely Shomer Shabbat, but we identify by Orthodox. And then there was a little bit of a rift there just in terminology, because for a Canadian Jew, Orthodoxy represented a more of a strict observance. These things happen and terms are used differently, and this was something that needed to be negotiated. Right? You see what I'm saying?
Well, absolutely, because South Africans, the majority, I mean, of course there's progressive Jewry here, but they're far in the minority. The majority of South Africans are what we would have called Orthodox, or what we call Orthodox. We really don't know much different. My experience in different parts of the world is definitely that there's a shift away from that, although, you know, there's still religion. But religion plays a very big part in South African Jewry, and it wouldn't surprise me what you're saying, that, you know, they want to hanker after that orthodoxy, and I could imagine that there would be a rift because, you know, the world outside of South Africa is progressing along a different line. And it's not so much of the orthodoxy, it's becoming more involved in what do you call it, not traditional, but...
Well, we have Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox.
Right.
Are the main movements here in North America.
It's more conservative than
conservative than
we are, yes. Reform is not mainstream here by any manner of means. It's just, you know, just it is there and there are... A number, but it's by far in the minority. I'm not saying that it's good or bad, but in the Hebrew of David, we don't discriminate, so you can be Reform or Orthodox, as long as you're Jewish, that's the criteria. But Orthodoxy and the mainstream shuls here, and I mean Chabad and Lubavitch and all of the those type of Jewish sects or whatever you want to call them, have become very prominent and very active here, very influential in the community.
Yeah, so it's interesting that South Africans identify often as Orthodox, but don't understand that term in the same way as some Canadian Orthodox Jews, where they have high levels of synagogue attendance here in Toronto, and they are usually more Orthodox or traditional synagogues, not the more reform or liberal ones. But that doesn't mean that they're keeping all the laws extremely strictly in terms of kashrut and Shabbat, as I mentioned. So someone mentioned that, well, we're non-observant Orthodox Jews. N-O-O-J, non-observant Orthodox Jews, N-O-O-J. We're nudges, they said.
I think today in South Africa that's quite far from the mainstream because a lot of Jews, I mean, I'm not saying that they're non-observant, but and they do attend, you know, once or twice or three times a year, but a lot of people are involved in the shuls. I mean, in the area where I live, which is the Greater Glen Hazel area, we have something over 30 different shuls. I mean, some of them are small shtibbles, but at the same time, you know, you won't go short of finding a shul. And when you know, on a Shabbos, people are walking both directions, so which shul are you going to, et cetera, which is... But I did find that Toronto has a high percentage of dati, of from Jews. I mean, you have kosher supermarkets and...
Absolutely. We have very strong from community. You know, it's perhaps 15%, perhaps 20% of the community, and strong infrastructure, neighborhoods, synagogues, kosher supermarkets, absolutely. And again, going back to South Africans, high levels of synagogue attendance, as you're suggesting, higher than the average Canadian Jew. And some other dimensions of Jewish identity also show a very highly Jewishly engaged community. For example, one of the most popular measures are intermarriage rates. And in our sample, the intermarriage rates were very low of the South Africans, perhaps only 5%, which was much lower than the Canadian Jews in general or Toronto Jews. And interestingly, even lower than the South African Jews who had moved to the UK. So... one can only speculate what might be happening there. Jewish education is a very important value to South African Jews. High proportion of the immigrants had gone to Jewish day school or certainly cheder, and a very high proportion send their kids to Jewish day schools here in Toronto, which we have many to choose from. And so more South Africans send their children to private schools than the Canadian Jews.
So that is a goal of certainly the education, Jewish education in South Africa, is that no Jew should be left behind. The community wants, certainly the leaders of the community want young Jews in school going to go to Jewish day schools, and I would say that by far, far the majority of Jews, of young Jews, go to those Jewish day schools. And so, yes, I can imagine that that's carried over. And it is my experience that the, you know, overseas, Australia and in the United Kingdom and certainly in America, that they've continued with that and they are involved in at that level. I think it's very important because that is the part that I think they took from this country, which was a very big positive, that, you know, Jewish education was important. The shul was important. It was the center of activity. And most Jews are in some way affiliated with and on a growing basis, very from, very much involved in the shuls here. So I'm sure there's a carryover to other countries. That could have been, that probably is influential in making the choice of where they're going to go. You know, what they would find. Education and religion have got to be high priorities.
Yeah, there's certainly an excellent infrastructure here of Jewish schools to choose from, and also camps, summer camps. South African Jews are attending summer camps at very high levels. And, of course, I know how important Zionist youth groups are in South African Jewish history. Although they're not as common here, as you may know, Zionist youth groups are not as prominent here. The Jewish day school, in a way, is the place to really express one's commitment to Jewish culture. But there are Zionist youth groups here for sure, and South Africans, of course, are very involved in them as well.
Right. We don't have – that's also something which has really slipped in South Africa. I mean, there used to be most – Jewish kids were involved in some way in these Jewish movements, whether they were Habonim or Beitar, all these others. They must have taken a lot of that with them. A lot of them found their way into the Hebrew Order of David. They were good candidates because they understood that side of it. And so, yes, I think that if they were able to continue with those activities and bring their children up into that type, Zionism for South Africans is very important. Israel plays a very big part in thinking of Jews in South Africa, and they're very much encouraged to go to Israel and be part of it as part of the curriculum. So, yes, and I would think that that's got to be a carryover into other countries. And, in South Africa, we tend to be absolutely wholeheartedly supporting Israel no matter what. We think that Israel can do no bad, but...
That's maybe a little bit different over here.
Yes, it always reminds me of my mother-in-law. She, when she was a kid, she went to Israel, the family immigrate, and they finally came back here, but she was driving past somewhere and she saw a big wall. So she said, "What's that?" I mean, she must have been 10 or 11 or something. And they said, "That's the jail." She said, "Jews? Have they got Jews in the jail? Are you serious?" Jews go to jail. So yes, I mean, you know, it's, what are you thinking? But yeah, so can I take you on a slightly different tack? You wrote a book, Jewish Family Identity and Self-Formation at Home. Just give us a little bit of that, because I think that ties into this, what little I know of that. And I haven't managed to get hold of the book, but I intend to, but, it looked like an interesting study of the influence of home and, you know, what you were talking about now about Jewish identity, which I think is a problem worldwide for Jews generally.
Yes. So this book I published last year with my British Israeli colleague Alex Pomzen was a longitudinal study. So it was over 10 years, which was unique in itself, in that we were able to be in touch with Jewish families here in Toronto over a 10-year period and interview them several times over the decade, and to look at how Jewish identity changes over time in the family. And one of the main emphases of the book was the family as a system, so that a lot of Jewish identity research looks at Jews as individuals and surveys them and asks their own opinions and behaviors. But I think what is missing is to see how one member of the family influences another very much as a cohesive unit. And that's what the book tried to look at. For example, as the children get older, the conversations at the Shabbat dinner table may turn to more complex subjects on Israel-Palestine, and this can influence the discourse in the whole family and can get the parents thinking in different ways. Or now the kids are older, now the kids are 6 or 7, maybe we need to join a synagogue so that the kids have some exposure. And so children very much influence adults and how a family system operates. Sometimes we don't think of that. And the other emphasis of the book was was the issue of the home. I think that Jews, to a large extent, despite what we've been saying about South African Jews, Jews are becoming in some ways less interested in synagogues and institutions outside of their home, the more liberal Jews especially. And a lot of what happens in terms of Jewish family life is what happens right there in your living room, in your dining room, at the Shabbat table, especially Passover Seders, and the power of ritual and family cohesiveness and family tradition. And so what the book was trying to shine a light on is the power of the family, and specifically at home, and what policy implications we might think about given some of the transitions that are happening in Jewish life today.
So, Professor, I'm sorry that we've run out of road. I think we could have had this discussion going on, and I'm really going to invite you back. Also, I know that you a subject which is a little bit touchy at the moment in South Africa, about Jews and homosexuality, and if you don't mind, I'd love to invite you back at some point. And my show is on every Thursday for the HRD, and if you wouldn't mind being a guest again, it's been fascinating, and I'm sure that this podcast will be sent around the world, and Canadians would like to hear what you've said. And thank you so much for agreeing to come on the show. And to the listeners out there, good Shabbos, and have a great weekend.
Okay, well, thank you very much. It'd be my pleasure to speak to you again.
Thank you.